Welcome to episode 43 of Gallifrey Public Radio. This week we talk about all the gadgets and toys that make every other sci-fi show seem a little less cool. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 43 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we take a peek at the Doctor's Toy Box and find more gadgets than a Brookstones and Sharper Image combined. This week we are taking a look at the tech of Doctor Who. My name is Jay, and with me this week are Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir. Yourself?
Doing well. And Melissa, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great, thank you. All
right. So yeah, we've got a show that has all kinds of different gadgets and gizmos, and we wanted to take a minute to take a look at some of that stuff and look into what toys the Doctor has.
Right. Now, one of the great things about a show like this is because of the nature of the fact that it is just a general entertainment sort of science fiction slash, call it what you will, but family targeted. There's lots of opportunities for them to be able to say, oh, well, we've written ourselves into a fine mess of a situation here. We need some piece of, hoolywhatsits to get us out of this situation. And you might have instances where one piece of technology is used for a single episode to get you out of a Russell Davies kind of a situation or what have you. We wanted to make a conscious effort to avoid the little one-time wonders. But by the same token, there's a very large piece of technology that we also decided to step to the side of because it probably warranted at least an episode in and of itself. So we left the TARDIS out of this one. So everybody just relax. It's not that we omitted it, through our own stupidity. We omitted other things through our own stupidity. This one was intentional.
Yeah. So we've got, all kinds of stuff. Obviously, the big one, let's go ahead and start with this, the sonic screwdriver.
Yeah. So we've complained about the sonic screwdriver a lot lately. So right. I think this is now the point to, get into it, get, the history and...
Yeah, exactly. Lately, it has become a bit of a magic wand, but it wasn't always that way. People wouldn't have collections of these things if it weren't completely and totally awesome.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the iconic nature of it is really targeted more to New Who, because in Classic Who it was such a there again, gone again sort of an implement or tool, really, and that's really all it was, that there were long stretches of time, in fact, entire iterations of the Doctor where it was not used at all. So I guess it, some sort of a decision since the 2005 reset to not only bring it back, but bring it back in increasing utilization, application, reliance. Really relied on a lot for a number of episodes to get him out of some jams.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I think that it's partially, part of the each Doctor, because Eccleston used it quite a bit, but it was always it was a tool. He had no reason to do it. He talked about the settings and things like that, so it was clearly a piece of technology to him. David Tennant would use it, and it came out frequently, but it was a quick thing, sometimes almost like a nervous habit kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Matt Smith is the one who, will constantly pull it out and use it for any situation, regardless of whether it fits or not. And I'm not sure how much of that is scripted and how much of that is, Matt Smith playing the role.
I would imagine that a great degree of it is scripted. There's a lot of times where its implicit use is written directly into the situation so that without it, there would be no no advancement of the story at that moment.
Yeah, but there's a lot of times where he's just standing there delivering dialogue, and he scans around the room and then pulls it up and looks at it, and it has no bearing except it's a visual thing for him to do while he's delivering dialogue. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag there.
Mm. Yeah, and you're absolutely right about how it's just evolved. When we complain about Sonic Screwdriver being a magic wand, it is only Eleven who does that, because I've gone back and watched a couple of Ninth Doctor episodes recently, and it's completely different the way he talks about it.
Mm-hmm. You look at some of the applications. I mean, it had been always, even in the earlier Doctors, where it was being used for things which were directly attributed to what it was described to be, a tool that used sonic frequencies to accomplish various tasks. And even in the cases of like the third Doctor, Pertwee had to, which is one of the first ones that really had some sort of a shape and form to it. In fact, you know, second Doctors really just look like a light pen,
yeah,
for all intents and purposes. But it was an interchangeable head on the thing, which meant that, you know, based on the application, he had to, rather than just changing settings, you know, and Tennant loved to be able to describe how many thousands and thousands of possible settings there could have been, and Smith as well. This was a matter of you had to actually modify the tool in order to accomplish different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, things like opening locks, which was obviously one of the or undoing screws, which were some of the more immediate applications. If you wanted to accomplish something like, a motherboard repair inside a supercomputer, because at the time we're talking supercomputers, not personal computers,
yeah,
required a change of tech. So, but by no means was it being used to sit there and hold, like Akaten, where you're holding up a multi-ton stone door by standing underneath it and pointing it over your head. It just, that was unfathomable prior to that point. So they've made some huge changes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, it was interesting the way that it started out. I mean, there were, yeah, like you said, it was just very basic, like, you know, he needs to have a tool to do this, and we could very easily use a standard tool, but this is a sci-fi show. Let's give him an extraordinary tool. So, I mean, that's where the whole basis for this came from, is just they wanted something that served a purpose, but could do so in a futuristic fashion.
Well, and also I like the idea that it's more that it's his weapon, and his weapon is a tool for opening doors rather than a gun or something like River Song or Jack Harkness would use. Like
that's something that the 10th Doctor said during, I believe it was Army of Ghosts, where the Dalek said, you know, you're completely unarmed, and he's like, I've got this, and it's like it's a sonic probe, and you know, it was just like, you know, your weapon is a screwdriver, really, and yeah. So I mean, they've made reference to it before, and yeah, it's a great thing.
Yeah, but that's just it. You wouldn't even want to qualify it or describe it as a weapon, because just as the Doctor, as we recognize him now, apart from how his foes and his nemesis like to describe him in terms of being some sort of a warrior figure. If we see him as the Doctor, then the Doctor doesn't carry a weapon. You know, the Doctor carries tools, implements.
Mm.
So,
and I think that's part of the reason why it's gotten to bother me so much lately, is that, you know, it's become the sonic screwdriver solves the problem, and the Doctor's just the one holding it, where it should be the fact that, you know, it's the Doctor is solving the problem, and he just happens to have this tool to do it with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wait, here, look, this is the list of things that it's been used to do. Interception of signals ranging from transmat beams to conscious thoughts, medical diagnostics and repair of organic parts, cutting, but also reattaching materials such as barbed wire, operating earth machinery such as computers and cash machines, creating a spark to light a candle or Bunsen burner, pushing and lifting heavy objects, which in Rings of Akaten, that bothered me, and on rare occasion, driving screws without touching them. And he's also used it as a defensive weapon. He has put it in a sound board to destroy the robot Santas in Runaway Bride. Used it to bounce sound waves off a knife that Melody Pond had to knock it out of her hand and Let's Kill Hitler. I think that's it.
It just
I like this. List, he tried to use it. No, go on.
The list just grows exponentially, or at least the kind of applications suddenly break away from what we would expect for opening and closing doors or things of that sort, to things that become more technology related in terms of application or manipulation of computers and machinery, which perfectly, you know, totally accept. Mm-hmm. I'm totally fine with that. But when you start getting into things where it's now, actually modifying computer code, you know, to turn off security systems or things of that sort, or creating sonic locks, or sonic enclosures that would be able to keep other sonic devices, you know, from being applied. It became an easy out.
Yeah.
A lot of aspect.
I mean, let's be honest. It's always been a magic wand. Yeah, regardless of how it was that they dressed it up, that's always been the use of it as far as script goes. The difference is that they have been able to disguise it much better. It's been much more like, okay, yeah, I can understand something doing that before. Lately, it's just been they've thrown it out the window, and it's like, nope, he points the screwdriver at it, and everything's okay.
Right, like I actually think it's okay that he can use it to change computer code or whatever. Like the technology things, it makes sense. It's this futuristic weapon. It's the things like lighting a Bunsen burner or holding up a door that make no sense to me.
Right. You've got to see some of the things that are done in the extended material then. I mean, in terms of what's done in the graphic novels, what's done in the audiobooks, it's ridiculous. Get down to, and you can probably see this, is some of the notes that we had taken for each other. There's actually applications in some of the audiobooks where it makes toast.
Oh, nice.
Toast. Freaking toast.
What? You know, the doctor's got to eat. How else is he going to do it?
No, he doesn't. or being able to actually, we had this in one of the episodes, to facilitate teleportation. That I don't quite follow.
Wait, when was that?
Music of the Spheres, actually. It actually sent what was that guy's name? The Grasky, shot him to the other side of the universe. It's just, I don't know. I was not. And granted, that was even under 10th, where they still even had a little bit of control at that point, or a little bit of restraint about some of the applications. But take them away from the television material too, and it just went way, way out of hand. Yeah. And then it seemed like such an odd novelty when they would actually use it to loosen or tighten a screw. Like, oh, okay, can do that too.
Hey, that's kind of
cool.
Like
looking down at your iPhone and saying, "God, it makes phone calls too." Wow.
Crazy.
But, but I mean, we've had all sorts of variations. We had the master who chose that for his variant, he didn't want to use a sonic screwdriver. He, being the quite upstanding young villain that he is, went straight to the laser screwdriver.
Yeah, laser.
Screw the sonic wave stuff. I'm going to zap you straight off.
Right, which can age you hundreds of years.
Well, yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, I mean, lasers can remove wrinkles now. Why not?
Exactly. Why not? Yeah, I would want one that you point at people and they become gorgeous. But speaking of beauty, I was saying the one variant that I always thought was a little odd, but then again, sort of endearing in a way, was the sonic lipstick that had been given to Sarah Jane.
Yeah.
I wanted to include it just because it was one of those things where you realized, okay, you guys are coming dangerously close to jumping the shark on this in terms of actually utilizing an object like this. But then again, this is who we also have, you know, River Song running around with psychic lipstick, for that matter, you know, you get what you get.
I can't wait for the day that kind of thing is invented. I will use sonic lipstick and psychic lipstick to no end.
Thankfully, Sarah Jane did not crack out the lipstick too often. Or when she did, it was really more, again, back to practical utilization. So maybe that's one of the reasons why I didn't have as much of an issue with it.
But. Yeah, I was just telling Jay before the podcast, I've never seen any of the Sarah Jane Adventures. So that sounds a little off-putting, but when you say like it wasn't used a lot, that's maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider that, you know, everyone talks about how the Doctor Who is a children's show. No, the Sarah Jane Adventures, that was the children's show.
Yeah, quite.
Very much
and,
so.
And actually not a bad one at that. You know, as far as spinoffs go, I mean, you go through a couple seasons of it, and if that's something you could definitely sit an 8 or a 10 or a 12-year-old down in front of and have no concerns about, you know, this isn't like Goosebumps where every once in a while you throw one at them that's really going to freak them out. These had their monsters and their baddies and their aliens and their, you know, things like that, but it was all done very, very much with the state of the viewer in mind. But still had a little bit of that Who charm to it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But I digress. Right,
so, yeah. Yeah, I think that's. Oh, the thing that I wanted to say about the Sonic Screwdriver is also at one point he made a reference to it's Sonic. Sonic equals sound. And because that had been bothering me for so long, I'm like, what is the sonic element of this? And I thought of it when we were talking about the laser screwdriver. Like, at least like that makes a little bit more sense. Like, sonic. Like, if you're using sound to accomplish all these things that we just talked about, that it's even more far-fetched.
Well, but then the early applications actually make a little more sense because they happen to do with, you know, being able to resonate things at a very high frequency, which causes, you know, parts to move and things of that sort. I can grasp that.
Yeah, I mean, they've actually, I think it was MIT was actually working on a real life sonic screwdriver, which used sonic waves to loosen a screw. Really? It's this huge machine, and I don't even know if they've actually gotten it to work yet. They've just it was in theoretical stages when I read it, but yeah, it was they're actually trying to accomplish that, and it's like, okay, well, I can accept the loosening of screws now. Yeah,
but very true.
The thing that bothered me the most was. In The Girl Who Waited, the fact that Amy was able to construct one herself. I'm like, you know, this is just so far beyond technology that any of us could possibly understand, and she just happened to be able to make one out of spare parts.
Over the course of 30 years.
Still. Amy's pretty much a superhero at this point. She makes me feel inadequate.
And it looked seriously jacked up, too.
Yeah.
To her credit, it was a hinky-looking piece of material.
Yeah.
Which no one has done replicas of at this point. Nobody really wants one.
No one wants.
I want River Songs because at least that looks kind of steampunk and cool.
Yeah. All right. Anyway. All right. So moving on. So the next one that we've seen quite frequently, but as far as I'm aware, is just a new Who invention is the psychic paper.
Original mention goes all the way back to Troughton.
Okay.
Yes.
So, and it was actually at one of the points where one of the episodes where we're starting to, and this is just based on some of the written material, and I don't know, I think based on where it occurred or when it was written in, the text itself that it was written into was from 2005. So it was attributed to Second Doctor, even though it was written during the time where they were going to be incorporating it into a Ninth and Tenth. But they had given it the backstory that the Doctor had been given the utilization of the psychic paper, because it was a matter of his involvement with the Celestial Intervention Agency and the Time Agents.
Okay.
So it was a matter of during his tenure or during his service to the CIA, different CIA than we.
Crime Lord CIA.
But it was their development, and it was given to him for utilization at that point, and they just decided bring it back up again until we came around to Ninth Doctor, with some heavy. You do notice that the idea that the Captain Jack had an issue of this, you know, had his utilization of psychic paper as well, which again connects to the idea of the fact that it was something that the Time Agents and the Celestial Intervention Agency used as part of their bag of tricks.
Mm.
Yeah.
Along with vortex manipulators and things of that sort.
Okay. So this has been one that's kind of been bounced around a little bit, and like they've kept relatively close to the same story, but I've noticed there have been sometimes where it's, you know, the doctor will explain it and it'll be, you know, it displays what you want them to see. And then there's other times where it's like, no, it displays what, you know, they expect to see or something like that. And it's always just kind of, the phrasing is just different enough that it could be completely different meanings. But, you know, I don't think it's something that anyone has ever sat down and said, okay, what's the science behind this?
Right.
Yeah.
Or the fact that it's used bidirectionally, that can also be used as a communications means.
Yeah, so messages have actually, he receives messages. I thought, when we were talking about this, I remembered that River Song had sent him a message on it. And then I went to the wiki, and he's gotten messages from the Face of Bo, the Atraxi, Tenzas, whoever that is.
Now,
The
Face of Bo is one that I could always kind of understand because, like you said, Kier, Captain Jack had it and knew its experience. And if he then becomes the Face of Bo, he would understand how to send a message to it. Right. So, that was always my way of saying, okay, then the doctor, you know, from there could figure out how to do it and, you know, tell River or something. It's just, you know, it becomes easier to hand wave it if you look at it that way.
Yeah, that's true.
But then I was going to say, and then I thought of an answer myself. Kate Lethbridge-Stewart uses it in The Power of Three, but obviously the break could have... If the second Doctor had it, then I'm assuming third Doctor and so on had it, so...
Right, and had never been attributed for... Yeah, or we have no stories about the application of the usage. But it could also have been a matter of not necessarily having pronounced psychic ability so much as it is a strong personal connection to the Doctor that spans that kind of time. And if you've got the Briggs daughter in this particular case, knowing all of the Brigadier's backstory and decades with the Doctor, that may have been a sufficient connection or what have you. Just a thought.
Hmm. So I personally
love the application of the paper. I love the instances where it works versus doesn't work.
Oh yeah.
Or when it goes on the fritz or what have you, doesn't quite behave properly.
I think one of the greatest ones was in the Doctor Who Christmas special I can't even remember the name of it now. The Christmas Carol,
right, with the kid.
Yeah, and he says, look, I'm a responsible adult, and he says it's just a bunch of squiggly lines. Ah, finally a lie too big. Yeah, it's like if anything could break the psychic paper, yeah.
I mean, I took that, though, it goes back to, does it show what people want to see or what he intends for them to see? And I think that kid just saw through the BS, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I like the fact that if it has that kind of connection, if he's trying to pull one over that's just a little bit too much, then the psychic paper even then says, no, pal, you're out of your MLM on this one.
Yeah.
There was a great clip out there, too, by the way. I noticed the fact that, this could have been something where, in a lot of the Doctor's applications, he's trying to wheedle his way in or out of, government agencies and things of that sort. It could have been perfectly used. I mean, it's just a matter of it's a pass that could be used at the gate of any military base or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some of these great clips out there of a third Doctor going to see the Brig on base, and the gate guards giving him a hard time, saying, well, you need credentials. You need more than just to be able to say that you're merely a doctor. And he says, I don't have – he gets really nasty about it. He kind of bitch slaps the guard, effectively saying, I don't have the time to deal with all of your petty running around with checklists and clipboards and whatnot. Get in there and notify the Brigadier that the doctor is here to speak with him and bring him by forthwith. And he just sits there at Bessie and crosses his arms. And just the sheer force of it, the guard's like, okay, I guess I should make the phone call. Loved it.
Yeah. So yeah, this is definitely something that is used never like this is never the thing that saves the day. This is just a quick plot device or, you know, comic relief kind of thing. That's usually when it comes
in the door more than.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's never become something that could be a point of contention. It's just a real quick, and I think that shows that it's done properly. Yeah, the fact that it's just, you don't think about the fact that they're using this, you know, magical plot device. It's just, okay, yep, psychic paper, moving on.
Mm-hmm. So it's a universal ID when it functions.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work on certain people. It didn't work on Shakespeare.
No, because people of a certain psychic level or overall intelligence, it would be non-functional. Which was great, you know, when Shakespeare looks at it, it's blank paper. Ah, yeah. Move on. Next tactic.
Yeah.
But speaking about issues for Time Agent equipment or basic construct, we've got one of the most bandied about, argued concepts of time travel that sort of flies in the face of the more complex means of getting around from time A to time B in the form of the wrist strap or vortex manipulator.
Yeah.
The doctor himself has gone through a couple of different opinions of these as well. A sort of love-hate relationship with the little device.
Yeah. He's not liked it, then he's used it, then he's talked trash about it, and then it's just been something that existed, and he's never been real consistent on it. It's just, it all depends on where he's at that moment.
Mm. I remember when we were getting around to all of the jumping around Pandorica. Was it Pandorica?
Yeah.
Running around with the mop and the whatnot, and it was just getting to the point where he even admitted that it was a habit that he had to break.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more you used it, the more reliant upon the idea of being able to bounce around it could possibly be. And it was dangerous in that regard. But then again, we've got River, who absolutely loved it. You know, she thought it was just a very slick little piece of tech that would allow her to, you know, cut through traffic like a motorbike.
Mm-hmm.
So
does it? I mean, I think I remember now. I wish I had kind of research this a little bit more, but like, it works different ways in different episodes. Like, that sometimes you can go, you know, wherever you want in time, and sometimes it's going to conflict with things. I feel like it was very inconsistent, but I don't remember exactly why.
I think it was subject to the same sort of issues of accuracy as other time travel devices like the TARDIS itself could be, depending on the usage or the extent to which it was being forced to function. I think there might have been an issue where it would run into conflict with or in the proximity of it was safe within the vortex, but when it was in proximity to other time manipulation devices, it was not always reliable. And it had a limit to the number of individuals that it could carry, I believe.
I think that was
The details on it. I don't know. I mean, it's just I think in some of the instances where we saw it being used with some frequency. I mean, and it was really within a single episode. I mean, we're bouncing here, there, back, forth. Forward through timelines, it almost seemed like you were running a huge risk of creating within the episode, you know, paradoxes that fly in the face of some of the rules of time that we had established for the show itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crossing over your own timeline, bumping into yourself every once in a while, and like, guys, I know it's a cute little convention to have people bouncing in and bouncing out, but just watch your continuity here a little bit.
Yeah, and that's something that's always been kind of, you know, played with, and it's how strict they are with it is, you know, strictly based on what they need to accomplish with the script. So, yeah, especially when you throw something in like the vortex manipulator, it just becomes way too easy to conflict. And I mean, this let's face it, this show loves to conflict itself. And that was just, I'm glad that it kind of got swept under the rug and taken out, because it was getting to the point where I was like, this is going to cause all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Vortex Manipulator, though, has been used up until, I think the last time, I might be wrong, was when Doria Maldivar said, I got it off the wrist of a young Time Lord. I mean, Time Traveler, Time Agent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's when River first got it. The last time...
Oh, but she used it in Angels Take Manhattan.
Yeah, the last time we saw it was Angels Take Manhattan.
Yeah.
But even then, that was okay, because it was like, let's explain why River is here, and now it's done. You know, it was just, that was all it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
And actually, this is another interesting piece of technology, because it's like the, you know, we have some sonic technology in Sarah Jane Adventures. Torchwood. He still has this vortex manipulator in Torchwood.
Yeah, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it works actually in one episode to open the door. And that's the only time I remember him talking about it.
Quick, have Jack use a sonic screwdriver. Oh, wait. All right, fine.
The vortex manipulator. He's got this thing on his
wrist. He's got to do something. Let's forward him in time to the time where the lock actually opens on its own, and then send that back.
Yeah. So,
One of the items that I wanted to include, just because it seems to get... we get a fair amount of mention from it, or at least I was always kind of fascinated by it, because it reminded me very much of a kind of a Douglas Adams sort of thing, was the perception filter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the idea of having technology that was keeping things not from being invisible, but being unnoticeable or unmemorable, so to speak. The idea of the corner of your eye sort of a thing.
Now, if you ever attended high school and felt slightly invisible, you understand this technology so very well.
Quite a bit.
This is something I think about all the time, because it's so true that, like, if you act like you belong somewhere, you can just walk in, and if you're unobtrusive, like, people don't even notice you're there. All the time I'm thinking, it's as if I had a perception filter.
Exactly. Or when they misfunction, you know, the idea of being able to be recognized as a certain thing, and then, you know, you make that one error, or the tech isn't quite working in your regard, and suddenly you're amazingly visible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this had a great setup. You know, obviously in Sound of Drums, because you know, Tenth goes through this with Martha to great detail, explaining, you know, this is one of the more thorough explanations we get of some of the technology that gets used in these things.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on, we get to see its applications. Obviously, the fact that it's to a certain degree, it's a variant of the kind of chameleon drive that's being utilized within the TARDIS. It has connection, obviously, to the idea of the personal appearance manipulation that gets utilized by the Time Lords through their fob watches, and most memorable, obviously, the Master's watch.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that has been recurrent, and I always found it really kind of interesting. It just reminded me a lot of the. I don't know if either of you have read a whole lot of Douglas Adams and Hitchhiker's Guide and things like that, but there was the mention of the idea of an SEP, a someone else's problem.
Yes, yeah.
Which was something that you wouldn't necessarily pay attention to, because the moment you started to realize what was going on, you realized that it wasn't your issue in the first place, and you just ignored it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Always reminded me of an SEP.
Yeah. And, you know, we've seen this actually quite a few times, and one of the times that most recently was the vampires in Venice, where you know, you've got the fish people using them to look human, and yeah, you know, the explanation that, you know, you can still see their fangs because how did he describe it, the self-preservation kind of kicks in, and you know, you can still see that even though it's trying its hardest to make you look, you know, make you think it's something else, you can still see that because you're in danger. So it just shows a little bit of the, you know, the restrictions of it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
We had a heavy use of the perception filter in the Lodger episode, the entire top floor of the house.
Yeah.
You know, just some giant filter. So This is one that I'm okay with when they utilize it. I'm not thinking.
I was just gonna say that. Yeah, this feels different than it's not a Deus Ex Machina. Like it actually is. I think it's because of Sound of Drums or whatever that was, where he explains it a lot and it makes sense.
Yep, and it's used for both positive and nefarious purposes, depending on whose hands it's in. So
yeah,
you know, it's not like it's a. You know, it's our weapon against you guys or what have you. This is just something that it's out there for some of the more advanced civilizations or races. And you've just you have to be aware of the fact that when things are slightly off, there's a good chance that they're off because you're seeing things through a perception filter.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, this is one of these Whovian techs that I like. I can get behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we also, all right. So I know, Kier, this is going to be your favorite entry into the list here. So why don't you go ahead and take this one?
I'm going to keep this real simple because I want people to be able to kind of discover a lot of these elements for themselves. And this is probably just because of my first affinity and my connection with Baker and Fourth Doctor was the introduction of K-9 and the idea of the little tin dog. Such a great introduction from the get-go because of the fact that, you know, it's not something that was just sort of handed to him. It wasn't like it was a matter of the episode starts up and there's this thing buzzing around the interior of the TARDIS and Leela says, oh, what's that? And Doctor says, oh, that's K-9. Don't worry about it. He's been here all along. Now this actually got a decent explanation as to why Professor Marius had developed this little cybernetic dog to be a data computational and translation device and things of that sort for its original intent, but because of the fact that he instilled it with a lot of his knowledge and artificial intelligence, he ended up with something that became far more than that and actually companion to the professor, and then later obviously. In giving the one of the versions of the K-9 to the doctor and later another copy, we've gone through variations of K-9. Just be aware of this.
What?
yeah, well, because you had K-9 and K-9 Mark II. So actually, you've had all the way through.
Before.
Yeah, it's before them. The distinction between some of the middle ones is a little blurry, and I think it happens through some of the text rather than through the episodes. But the vast majority of these are obviously happening all through Fourth Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It became so attached not only with Baker during that stretch, but then, obviously, the idea of the Mark III that was then given to Sarah Jane when she sort of ended her companionship to be her companion and her guardian, that when they decided to then revive the idea of the Sarah Jane adventures, you had to have K-9 there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole premise of the idea that he had been effectively protecting her at that point for 25 years since the last, when she was first handed her copy in 78, you know, to when we pick it up in 2006 or so, or when was Sarah Jane Adventures, 2006, 2007.
Something like that.
And he's still going strong. And is at this point, he's now an intrinsic part of the home security system. You know, he's maintaining time locks to be able to keep in all these atrocities that she's collected for the betterment of mankind. It's just an amazing little fun bit. And it was always fun.
Yeah.
Whenever he was involved, there were some serious elements of his accompaniment, but it was always one of those things where it was it fell back on the good old K-9 kind of thing, you know, that little metal protector. So very near and dear, personally.
Yeah, and K-9 is another one that I'm kind of like okay with because, you know, I remember Mickey saying he's a little bit disco and it's just a tin dog, but it's actually explained well enough. Like, they back it up enough that, you know, Professor Marius had a dog and he made his robot look like a dog. Like, you know, it actually, it all makes sense. And he, I like I said before, I've never seen Sarah Jane Adventures, but his time on Doctor Who is never too intrusive. Like, the stuff with, it's always fun. It's always, you know, stuff with the Fourth Doctor and, you know, it's lighthearted. They're not trying to say, like, oh my god, this dog saved the universe, you know?
But in one instance, he actually did. You know, you take it to Journey's End, yep, and you've got to, you know, we're trying to return the Earth to its right, you know, space-time coordinates when all the planets were moved around, and it was actually K-9 responsible for carrying the data from the TARDIS and to be able to relay them back for back to the Doctor so that he could return the Earth.
Okay, so, yeah,
he's had his instances. He also met, well, I don't know if I really want to get into the demise of K-9, but I might leave that out because it makes me sad. Okay. But K-9 committed the ultimate sacrifice. So that's a pretty rough little moment there for anybody that starts getting attached to that little tin dog. You can go ahead and enjoy that. Go ahead. I dare you. I love the fact that with all but maybe one instance, they did not look to update K-9.
Yeah.
He remained, you know, pretty much just the same little, you know, lunchbox with a, you know, with a tail and a couple of satellite dish ears, and didn't really look to make any sort of major advancements with it. The only time, and I have no knowledge of or ever being able to come across this. Apparently, Australian television decided that they were going to do a spin-off show called K-9.
Yeah, they filmed a pilot, and I don't think that it got further than that.
No. Yeah. So they decided they were going to do a sort of a children's program that sort of followed the same idea as the Sarah Jane Adventures, but this did not fly. And at that point, they had some sort of a, you know, hyper-realized, you know, updated K-9 that was supposed to be, you know, this amazing, you know, levitating thing. No. I want the simple remote controlled little, you know, lunchbox. I want my lunchbox.
Right.
So.
All right. So next we've got, well, all right, let's go ahead and talk about Bessie. Now, Bessie was the doctor, the third doctor's car.
Yeah.
When he was earthbound.
Yeah. While he was trapped on Earth. Yeah. So what I can't remember everything that made this car so special. Like, I remember it was more than just a typical car.
Yes, he did some modifications to it. Remember, Third Doctor being very much the scientist.
Yeah.
Or the return to the idea that he had roles and functions and reasons why. And especially when he found himself trapped on Earth without a functioning TARDIS, his only opportunities to be able to do a lot of the things to sort of serve those needs was to tinker around with Earth technology and sort of advance it as far as he possibly could, given what he was handed, mm-hmm, or the materials that he had. So he made some modifications. The fact that he was deciding to work with this ancient little roadster instead of anything else he could have utilized from the time is just part of the quirk. I mean, look at the way he dressed, for that matter, you know, with the cape and so forth. It was just, he had a personal style that just did not, that seemed out of time,
yeah,
so to speak. So, made his modifications so that he could have, primarily you were going to be able to see this thing used so that it could self-propel. At times that was through remote control, and at other times when it was actually given the ability to get to certain destinations without the remote control, as long as it knew where it was supposed to head. Where it got a little silly at times was when it had the ability to go into an extremely hyper speed, a little difficult to accept for this little clanky, you know, British roadster that literally you could take the hood off with your two hands. And all they did to sort of represent that was just to speed up the film.
Yeah.
So you've got things like the really bad Benny Hill kind of moments where everyone's just racing around at double speed.
Yeah.
But,
no.
But I like that it comes from him stealing a car, and he said, like, I'd like one of those, so they gave him a car. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's funny to think of the doctor exiled to Earth, and he's like, well, you know, what am I going to need?
Exactly. But it gets it became so identified with Third Doctor at that point that even when you get around to things like the Five Doctors special, Bessie had to be represented.
Yeah, you still got Bessie.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that this was included was just because of the fact that it was, while it didn't necessarily span multiple regenerations of the Doctor, we did see it occur in subsequent, you know, all the way up through to the point where I think we've got Sixth Doctor that even gets an opportunity to go back and Seventh Doctor, I'm sorry, had an opportunity to be able to look back and see the same model and think to himself, oh, it's just a reminder of me of old Bessie.
Yeah.
So, you know, the tip of the hat to it.
Yep.
Not to be confused, obviously, with the horrible Whomobile.
Oh, God.
Which was just a mistake.
I don't even know what that is. What is the
Whomobile? It was it looked like a really bad Jetsons spaceship.
Yeah,
it like was the one they drop the kids off at school in the morning with a dome and the wings and the whole bit.
I was completely unaware of the Whomobile's existence before we started recording this show, and I wish I could go back and erase it.
Yeah,
I do not want to know that this thing existed.
Yeah, it was a writing error. As I was trying to explain a little earlier, it was at a point in time where a lot of the television programs, both on both sides of the pond, were getting into the idea of saying that they were starting to get into product marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really not a matter of just having a hit show. Was the idea that you had to have some material that could then be sold, whether it be, you know, lunchboxes or T-shirts or what have you. And then they said, well, you know, these Matchbox cars and Hot Wheels and these things, these are starting to become immensely popular. So everybody should have a personalized vehicle. And if that's going to be the case, and you've got Doctor Who on the UK side of things, the last thing kids are going to want to play with is a Bessie.
Yeah.
So they developed the Whomobile because it looked spacey.
It bothers me because he's not Doctor Who, he's the Doctor. Did they ever call it the Whomobile? Like,
yes.
Yeah, yes, they did. That's what it was named.
I mean, you could even take the fact that on the front of Bessie, the vanity plates were Who Won, which was a bit much, but you kind of let it go.
Because it was Bessie.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that was, you know, in the credits, they, you know, in the classic series, they referred to him as Doctor Who, played by, you know, whichever actor. So it was different at that time. You know, it wasn't this, you know, divisive issue like it is nowadays.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
we cut him more slack.
So, all right, the next one that we've got is the Hypercubes. Now, most people would probably remember this from The Doctor's Wife. You know, this is the little glowy cube that the Doctor, you know, that knocks on the TARDIS's door, flies in and lets him know that the, what was his name? The Corsican or something?
Yeah. Oh, right.
I'm a bad Whovian.
the Corsair.
That's it. There it is, yeah. I knew it was something like that. Edit. but yeah, it was their like alarm system, basically their distress call.
Mm-hmm.
But this goes all the way back to the Second Doctor, I believe, doesn't it?
Yes. Yep. You had an instance where in one of the probably one of the better Second Doctor episodes, just in terms of, you know, it was. You talk about saying that, you know, a lot of the classic Who episodes are kind of hard to follow because the pacing is a little weird, the dialogue is a little unusual. War Games is actually a really interesting episode all around.
Yeah.
And it's actually written rather tight. I mean, the dialogue is tight. It's easy to follow. It's interesting and engaging. And it really allows Troughton to have a lot of fun with it, too. So you see at a point where he realizes against his better judgment he has to actually, in order to deal with these warlords, he actually has to call upon the Time Lords. And it's one of the first times the Time Lords actually get described to the companions, and he has to go into a little exposition as to that relationship. But in order to get in touch with them, he ends up laying out these pieces on the floor and going into sort of a meditative trance. Granted, come on, just giving you a little slack here, because knowing where we are, that it actually assembles itself into the cube. And in the process of doing so, as the cube assembles, it's accepting and recording all of the data that needs to be conveyed back to Gallifrey in order to tell them of the warning that's being issued about the warlords themselves. So it's actually kind of a cool premise. I'm surprised that they left such long gaps in something like this. Maybe because a lot of the time, sort of the in-betweens, the relationships with the Time Lords was very spiky, so maybe the idea of having a communication channel between them was not the best idea?
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the Doctor was usually at odds with the Time Lords in the classic series, and then we get to New Who, where the Time Lords don't exist, so who's going to send it? You know? So, yeah, there's all kinds of reasons why it's not included, but yeah, I mean, this is a cool little premise.
Yeah, and leave it to Neil Gaiman to bring it back, you know, because in New Who, there's really no more Time Lords to send them, so.
Yeah, so it's going to be something that comes in, you know, not as a plot device, but something that, you know, is separate of, you know, it's a separate issue that doesn't have to tie into all that.
Right. Well, I mean, it is a plot device, but like a well-utilized one that has, you know, it goes back.
Yeah, you know, getting the Doctor to that little bubble universe and whatnot. So, yeah, it works pretty well. Yeah, I mean, and it's very well accepted. You know, nobody that I know of has a problem with this. Nobody's like, oh, well, that's stupid. Why'd they bring that back? And, you know, I think it worked out brilliantly.
If I recall correctly, ThinkGeek was selling these. You can actually buy one as like a nightlight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That would actually be kind of a cool thing to have in your house. And people wouldn't really understand that it's a Doctor Who thing unless they were really dedicated.
Right. Yeah, it would sit right there on the shelf next to my my black cube from Power of Three.
You don't really have one, do you?
Not yet. I'm still looking for one.
That would actually be something cool to make on like a 3D printer or something. Like a black cube. That's the easiest thing in the world to make. Like,
yeah, but see, I wouldn't be happy.
I want it to light up. It has to light up.
I wouldn't be happy unless it had the light up number.
Well, or if it opened up and something cool came out of it. Mm-hmm.
You know, if it flew around the living room and shot lasers, even better.
Great.
So, all right. And we've also got the Matrix. No.
Yeah.
This is actually a really cool little thing that hasn't been touched on in New Who.
No,
yeah,
so much.
This is not my area of expertise, but I do remember Rassilon, I think, talking about it. So yeah, you guys take this one because I'm not a
right. Well, you were probably most recently introduced to this since I know that you got a chance to recently watch Trial of a Time Lord.
Yeah.
So obviously, yeah, during that trial, a lot of times the council was relying on data drawn from the Matrix in order to, you know, to for the prosecution.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you guys about that, because that's like this predates the movie The Matrix by a long time, and actually
just a couple years.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I mean, anything with actually Matrix, like, you know, but like it's very sci-fi Matrix.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Matrix is sort of it's sort of twofold. You got to kind of look at it at two levels. At one essence, it is basically just the database, the computer that basically utilizes the collective knowledge and gatherings of the Time Lords, and specifically the High Council. So it could just be said, okay, well, this is their repository for all the information they've amassed over the course of the millennia, and this is where it goes. They go one step farther to be able to use it sort of like, again, I'm going to give you a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the idea of the deep thought supercomputer that's able to sit there and calculate future events as a result of looking at all the amassed data that it has from the past. So, okay, with that, all right, yeah, I kind of get it. All right, that makes sense. Time Lords, they've gathered all this knowledge. They put it into a computer. The computer gets to the point where it has enough information that it can start making some logical, educated guesses and predictions. Okay, that's fine. They go one step farther, and they end up saying that one of the ways that it functions is by actually serving as a simulated reality. So you start getting into the idea of one of the ways that it is able to predict the future events is by actually playing them out and result being able to convey the results of its simulated applications. You run into a couple of instances, primarily there's some issues with Fourth Doctor, where he realizes in certain instances that he is within the Matrix, or that he is not actually where things are just a little unusual, and it couldn't possibly be happening, you know, the way that they are, and the laws of physics and chemistry and so forth are failing to comply, and it's just becoming a little bit too much of a bizarro situation. And he realizes that he is actually at this point, he is not viewing what he knows to be reality, or any form of a universe or parallel universe that he's been exposed to, but something is being fed to him, and realizes that he is within the Matrix, or experiencing from within the Matrix, and actually is able to will his way out of that illusion. The thing that really caught me was that, and somebody actually kind of put this together online much later, to put the connection together that at the time that those episodes that they aired, and that was The Deadly Assassin specifically with Baker, was right around the time that the Wachowski brothers, or now brother Wachowski. And sister.
Brother and sister, too.
Siblings. Whatever, were about ages 10 and, 12 and 14, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
So highly impressionable, probably knowing that they were, you know, geeks in their own right, probably watched quite a bit of sci-fi.
Yeah.
And had probably seen this. In fact, there's a clip that maybe we can put into the link dump afterwards, where you'll see that it could very well have been like almost verbatim the seed of the ideas for their films.
Yeah, I mean, this is speculation, but like I said, like, I have no experience with this, and every time that I have heard it, it sounds so much like the movies.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, this was a really cool application that they put in the show that could have taken it in a completely different direction had they put more into it. You know, it seemed like something that they kind of threw in and said, okay, this is getting too complex. We're getting in over our head. Let's, you know, not scrap the idea, but they never really went back to it too much.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's just because of the fact that we haven't had a whole lot of interaction with the Gallifreyan High Council in that regard. We had our opportunities, obviously, with the reemergence of Rassilon and that sort of thing, but I think that was... maybe if some of our suppositions are true and we end up having to deal later on with a return to Gallifrey or within the time lock, this could be utilized again. I mean, it's nothing that would be problematic for its mention or usage. So,
yeah, I don't know. I think that that's. it almost seems like something where it's like, if it's not the central element of the episode, then it's either going to be wasted or overshadow the story. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. It could make some really cool stories, but it could also destroy some really cool stories.
I guess it depends on the capacity in which it's used. If it's just being used to describe the fact that, okay, well, the information that the High Lord, the High Council is utilizing was you know, as drawn from the Matrix, and as a result of this information, we found that and they just sort of throw it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just mention the fact that, okay, in his next interaction, or the next next instance where we actually have to deal with the Time Lords, that they just mentioned that some information drawn to their attention or some predictions about outcomes as calculated by the Matrix, and they just give it that, you know, quick, just off the cuff mention. That's fine.
Yeah.
But if they go the route of actually saying, okay, we're dealing with simulated realities, we're dealing with the idea of making predictions on future events based on data that's been computed by our supercomputers, then it's going to warrant a little bit more modern explanation.
Yeah.
Because they haven't utilized it since Seventh Doctor.
Yeah, so it would take a lot to put that in more than just lip service.
Mm-hmm.
So. I mean, honestly, they could do it. They could like, I would like to say Moffat could do it, but I think Moffat would take it too far. Mm-hmm. I think, though, you know, with the groundwork that Moffat has laid and the way that things have been going lately, especially with these last couple episodes of Doctor Who, like, it could actually be like a really cool plot device if it was done correctly.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, like, you know, we've said before, Moffat is more about spectacle than science. You know, it's like, if it looks cool, he's going to include it. And if he can squeeze in an explanation later, you know, bonus. So
right.
I think something like this would be really cool in the hands of a very skilled writer who pays attention to that. You know, I would love to see another episode from Gaiman where he puts that in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because $10 says that he wouldn't even reveal that it was part of it until, you know, 3/4 of the way through. You know, you would just start out the episode, you know, all the stuff's going on, and then finally, you know, reveal, oh, they're in the Matrix now, and explain it then.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, it could be a really cool episode.
It would take a skilled writer to bring this one back. I'll say that.
I mean, at this instance, right now, I mean, we're talking about some of the more recent utilizations that Moffat's used. You take the whole idea of the transmats.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, you know, we never really anywhere along the way get a whole explanation as to how that whole technology or the transmission of matter actually functions and how it's different from any sort of other within the timeline, you know, just a physical teleportation. But it still gets popped up all the time. And it's just sort of utilized and expected. Okay, well, they used a transmat beam. Oh, they interrupted a transmat beam. Oh, they got here because they were transmatted in.
Mm.
All right. If I'm never going to get any more than that, then it's just one of those things where, you know, how does the transporter on the Enterprise work? Shut up. It makes some noise.
Yeah.
They glow.
I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of a double-edged sword where the more science you pour into it, the easier it is to poke holes in it. But if you don't put any science behind it at all, it's just like, you know, we complain about it being a magic wand. You know, so it's, you've got to find that balance. And I think with the transmat beam, you've got a wide area where it's just like, you know, if you mention it and you say, no, it transports matter from this area to this. Okay, so it's a transporter. Got it. We've seen that before in sci-fi. We don't need an explanation. We don't need the, you know, the science behind it or the, you know, schematics. We can accept that. But if you try and go too much into it, then it starts to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed.
So, well, that's about the whole list that we've got. I mean, obviously, there's all kinds of different things that we could have included. You know, the DMAT gun, the, you know, gadget from the waters of Mars. Yeah, there's all kinds of new stuff. But again, we're not trying to turn this into a 4-hour podcast.
Right.
So,
and we wanted to try to avoid the ones that were just the single opportunities that were being used to sort of propel a storyline or get them out of a pinch or something of that sort. We were trying to rely on the ones that had a little bit of staying power, either as a result of their popularity or just the fact that it seemed to be a convention that was best suited to the show, or at least to where the show was at the time, so that it warranted recurrence.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, there's plenty that we skipped over. You know, if there's a gadget that you think we should have included, or you have a particularly favorite that you want to share your voice on, you know, go over to Gallifrey Public Radio/43, put it in the comments. You know, we always check those. We always read them. We try and respond to everything we get. I'd love to see a discussion come up over there about, you know, the different gadgets and stuff and things that you loved or you hated, or, you know, just get something going over there. I want to see what people think about all this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we listed enough things here. Like, there were things that didn't make our list that we could have talked about, but we didn't go completely in depth with these. Like, you know, I'm sure someone is obsessed with the sonic screwdriver or something. Like, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so do that.
Yes, please. So we've got some news this week. There was a lot of hubbub about some possible, the entire archive of lost William Hartnell episodes being found.
Yeah.
You know, apparently they were in Nigeria or something. You know,
everybody keeps saying, you know, the stories emerge about every 4 to 6 months. The last time we actually did get any actual quantified material, the BBC came out and said, yes, we did find salvageable archives that can start to be revisited, restored, remastered, was back in 2011. At this point, though, until the BBC themselves come out and say they're in our hands, everybody else saying that, you know, so-and-so was cleaning off a rubbish bin and came across, you know, this old leather satchel full of, you know, whatever VHS tapes or what have you, or reel to reel for that matter. I'm going to take it with about as much salt as I take, you know, suppositions about the 12th Doctor's identity.
Yeah.
So, the Nigeria thing was just as I came across a little earlier today. And even then, when I tried to track down the article to see what the heck they were talking about, the article had been pulled. So maybe that was because they realized they were having their chain jerked or something. I don't even know.
Or maybe it was real and BBC got a hold of them and told them stop saying it. I'm getting excited. I'm gonna let you guys be. You guys act like it's no big deal, but I'll let myself get excited that maybe, just maybe, we're gonna get to see some unknown episodes.
Well, they had rumored months back that they had come across at least a handful of Hartnell episodes, including 10th Planet, which meant that there was this whole theory for a while that right before they released the Regeneration box set, DVD set that has just now come out, that they were going to actually include, as a surprise to all the purchasers, that it was going to include this restored episode so that we would have the actual filmed or the actual broadcast Regeneration of the First Doctor. Turns out that wasn't the case, and what actually ended up shipping with the DVD set was the I think we mentioned this maybe about a month and a half ago, the animated reinterpretation using the original audio.
Yeah.
Where they did a sort of a, I forget what they called it, the nature of the technology, but, you know, still done black and white, really interesting sort of animation style, and really gorgeous. It was really, really pretty to look at. But that was what they ended up including with the set for the regen. I still want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it's, you know, like you said, we get these stories all the time. I don't know why this one got so much more attention than it normally does. I think it's just because it's, you know, something other than 12th Doctor speculation. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, dear God, there's something more to talk about. And everybody just glommed onto it.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, for a while there, I was seriously wondering if it wasn't the BBC releasing, saying like, hey, tell somebody that we found something, just get them off the whole 12 Doctor thing. Yeah.
So. It's like, It's like, how many times is that story going to come around? We found a Dalek at the bottom of the pond. That one, oy.
Yeah. But in other news, David Tennant actually won an Emmy for his work in the Star Wars The Clone Wars.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see this. I mean, it was, I didn't really know the extent. I hadn't really been keeping up on Clone Wars to know how involved he was or the extent to which his character recurrence was. But kudos for something like that, especially surrounded by some of the other voice talent involved with that production.
Yeah, so. As far as I know, it was just the one episode. Granted, I haven't seen it. I don't know. Please stop writing the hate mail. I'm not sure how involved he was, but you know, it wasn't a whole lot. He played an ancillary character, and just, you know, granted, it was awesome. I mean, you've got the Doctor playing a robot who builds lightsabers for Jedi. I mean, that's just all kinds of cool. But you know, it was
The meta.
But yeah, I mean, for him to get an Emmy off that, you know, small part is amazing.
Yeah, I remember watching a clip of it on YouTube, but it wasn't, I don't think it was the episode that was nominated for an Emmy, and I was like, oh my god, David Tennant, like, it's so cool. Now I kind of, if it was Emmy worthy, which, you know, he's a great actor, I might have to check this out.
It's got to make the rest of the cast wonder, what the hell we've been doing wrong all this time? This guy walks in here and does one episode and walks off with a freaking Emmy.
Yeah. So some other stuff is we actually have a director for the Christmas special now.
Yes.
So
yes.
Jamie Payne will be directing the 11th Doctor's Exit. He's the one who directed the episode Hyde from Series 7B. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he's done anything else or if that was his first go as director. But the fact that Moffat has given him the go-ahead for the Christmas special and not only that, but the exit of the 11th Doctor is telling me that he's got a lot of faith in this guy.
Pressure.
Seriously. But.
No, so. I'm excited. Again, anything you're going to be able to tell me that gets me one step closer to these next two events, fine. I'll take any news you want to give me as long as it's confirmed and true.
Yeah. Exactly. So.
And then the last. News that I found a little while ago was that Prince Charles will be visiting the set of Doctor Who. It's part of like a Goodwill tour of Wales.
Yeah.
Which, you think of Wales as where it's all shot, and now lately it's not anymore. So, good for them. Good for Wales.
Oh, thank hooray.
You. You'll have actual royalty on the TARDIS instead of just people acting like it.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's going to be happening in the first week of July. And it's, I guess it's during what they normally refer to. They have some sort of a celebratory week or Wales week that I don't know if Wales calls it Wales week or whether the royalty
it's us week.
Yeah, it's me week. But it's the, or whether it's something that when the royalty heads out there, that's considered, you know, Wales week or something, just because they happen to be in town for a while. But it is actually the fact they're going to be making this visit is specifically because of marking the 50th anniversary. So
yeah.
Be kind of nice to see that it's actually the popularity of the show extends as far as Buckingham Palace.
I've heard rumors that the Queen watches it, which is really cool. So
that would be hilarious.
I think that's interesting. Yeah, especially that, you know, they're going to get visited by the future king is, you know, that's a big deal. Yeah, it doesn't happen for everything. But this is a part of British culture now. You know, you can't deny that. So, you know, the fact that they just cut the whole thing out of the opening ceremonies at the Olympics was a travesty, but, you know, I guess they're trying to make up for it now.
So, no, you could just barely hear the sound of the TARDIS during one of their awful songs. No.
Yeah.
Not good enough.
Nope. The torch needed to be lit by David Tennant. They missed an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Is that it for news?
I think that's it, yeah.
I think so.
Not a whole lot going on. You know, it's still quiet. Thankfully, it's kind of died down with the whole, oh no, it's you know, Prince Harry is going to be the next Doctor.
That I would watch.
My wife is still claiming that it's got to be Jason Statham.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I don't know. But anyway.
But actually, you know, speaking of this, like, I've actually had to break the news to some people. Like, I feel like I live on the internet, so we all knew, like, 30 seconds after it was revealed. But in real life, some people still don't know that there's going to be a new Doctor. And when you talk to them, they're like, what? And Matt Smith is leaving?
I was just getting used to his, you know, flopping around in slidey boots.
Even on the diamond plate. Yeah.
Exactly.
That takes talent. Well, yeah, like we said earlier, you know, go over to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/43, share your comments on there. You know, let us know what you think of the news and of the gadgets and things like that. You know, find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, head over to our Facebook page. Leave us comments on iTunes. We've gotten a few more of those, and we absolutely love that. So, you know, just get in touch with us and give us your feedback. We want to hear what you guys think about all this stuff.
Yeah, and actually, it's a good point about the comments on iTunes, because that affects our ranking, and the more current the comments are, the higher the ranking is. It doesn't matter what you actually say. So, if you commented once, comment again. Even like,
go back, you know, do it again.
Yeah.
Not good enough.
Share your thoughts in all the places.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All the places.
And just a reminder, we won't be having any new shows for the next 2 weeks. So the next show should come out probably July 12th. If you're coming to the site before that, or if you're just wondering where stuff is in the meantime, we're not going to have anything for a couple weeks. So you can still go to GallifreyPublicRadio.com. We will still have new content there. We're just not going to have any new podcasts until July 12th. So until then, this has been episode 43 of Gallifrey Public Radio. This is Jay saying, who's breaking? Sonic and entering. Completely different.
And this is Melissa saying, it doesn't work on wood.
And this is Kier saying, if reality is a computation matrix, I'd rather sit back with a bag of jelly babies and enjoy the fiction.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.